At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
You can say woulda, coulda, shoulda all day long, but here is an interesting one. What if the trade war had never happened? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today, the 3rd of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Our What If story coming up in a little bit. But first, there is an economic indicator that comes out every month that, to be completely honest, we don't report on most of the time because, well, supply chain management is few people's idea of a good time, is why. Letters at marketplace.org for the supply chain managers out there who would like to object. But before you send that email, consider this a mea culpa for our past transgressions, because we got the latest report from the Institute for Supply Management this morning, and it was jarring. Among other things, the ISM puts out a manufacturing index every month, literally how busy American factories are. And today's report, for the first time in 3 years, showed manufacturing in this economy is contracting. Not ordinarily a huge deal. There are normal ebbs and flows, but with all the other stuff that's going on, as I said, jarring. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
If you've ever been in a hospital bed or a doctor's office and seen those screens on the wall or by the bed with all the data coming through, Charles Stout's company makes those.
Largely to the dialysis market, emergency rooms, and things like that.
PDI Communication Systems has some assembly plants in China, some here in the U.S. They've been hit by the president's tariffs twice, once last year and again just this past Sunday.
We're reeling, trying to determine the directions that we can head.
That includes whether the company's going to hire more people. Stout's really not sure that's going to happen.
We're looking at, you know, cost-saving measures and things that we can do to maintain a competitive balance. You know, instead of planning where our business needs to go, we're spending our time planning what we need to do to react to the tariffs.
There are thousands of products out there made by companies experiencing the same frustration, and that is showing up in data. Daniel Zhao is a senior economist at Glassdoor.
We've seen growth in job openings slow quite dramatically in 2019.
Most dramatically, he says, among businesses connected to trade, where job openings have fallen 16% on the site.
Industries like manufacturing or transportation and logistics.
Government data also shows a slowdown in hiring. Part of this, Zhao says, is due to a slowdown in the German and Chinese economies. This is all not, so far, enough to pull the country into recession. Nick Bunker is an economist with the Indeed Hiring Lab, and he says there are still parts of the economy that are hiring at a healthy, though slightly slower, pace.
The service-producing part of the economy, which is a much larger share of the overall employment in the U.S. labor market.
That is, U.S. consumers are still pulling the economy along. But some industries are caught on tariffs, and they're getting left behind. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Phase number, honestly, I've lost count of the trade war kicked in this weekend. New U.S. tariffs that we spent most of last week telling you about. New or higher Chinese tariffs on our stuff as well. But let us, if we might, set tit and tat aside for a moment and remember that a stated goal of these Trump administration tariffs was to make things easier for American firms doing business in China to get rid of some of the lasting structural frustrations over there. So, lo these many rounds of tariffs later, how we doing? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
U.S. companies are loath to complain too much about their treatment in China, says Mary Lovely, a professor of economics at Syracuse University. They're trying to keep their heads down, trying not to draw too much attention from politicians. And she says conditions for firms operating in China don't seem to have dramatically worsened due to the trade war.
There are a lot of ways in which the Chinese authorities could, if they wished, harass U.S. businesses operating in China. And while there have been a few sporadic reports, we do not have any systematic evidence that that is happening.
China actually loosened some requirements that U.S. firms partner with a local Chinese company to operate there. Chad Bown at the Peterson Institute says Chinese officials are being careful not to give the U.S. ammunition or do things that might push U.S. businesses out of the country. But China is trying to make sure its tariffs hit U.S. companies. While raising tariffs on American goods,
they've also been lowering the tariffs that they charge on imports coming in from other countries. So to make it more attractive for, you know, say a Canadian or a Japanese or a German company to be able to sell into China.
Jacob Parker with the U.S.-China Business Council says in a recent survey of the group's members, almost half reported they've lost sales or market share to foreign competitors in China in the last year.
Because of the U.S.-China trade conflict and the perception among Chinese customers of our member companies that U.S. suppliers are maybe considered to be a little less reliable than they would have been in the past.
He says Chinese firms are trying to diversify away from U.S. products and services where they can, in part because of higher costs from tariffs, in part because they fear the U.S. might limit their access to them later. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, well, let's see, lousy manufacturing, more tariffs. What do you think? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You'd have to have worked really hard to have escaped the saga that is Uber. The company's rise, its no-holds-barred business strategy, and then the eventual fall of its founder and former CEO, Travis Kalanick. A fall, even as the company got more and more popular, that was precipitated by, among other things, sexual harassment of its corporate employees, lousy working conditions for its drivers, and privacy violations of its users, to name just a couple. Those stories and more are told in Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber by Mike Isaac. He covers technology for The New York Times. Mike, it's good to have you on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm just going to start with a declarative sentence, and I'm going to ask you to run with it. Uber, as a company, is kind of a jerk.
I think that's how to say it, how people see it, whether they like it or not. That's right.
So let's start somewhat-ish at the beginning. Travis Kalanick co-founds this company, and the ethos is, in essence, we will do whatever it takes to break into whatever market we want to get into, the heck with whatever the laws are. And I want you to start me where you start the book, in Portland, Oregon, in 2014, and them trying to get into that market there.
Yeah, that's right. So from the very beginning, Travis Kalanick knew that the taxi organizations and politicians that are established in different cities were going to fight Uber tooth and nail to keep them from entering every city that they were. So Travis, being Travis, decides that's not going to happen. And no matter what, he's going to win and he's going to get into a city. So where we begin is this idea around a software tool that they created internally called Grayball.
Yeah.
And essentially what it is a way to hide cars from the regulators in cities that were trying to pull Uber over when it was operating illegally and give them tickets or impound cars. So in Portland, where we start the book, Uber had sent out operatives to essentially spy on transportation officials and some police, tag their phones with the Grayball code, and every time those officials tried to call a car, they weren't able to, and Uber would recognize them and just like completely not let them use the service. So besides the ethics of that, it might be questionably legal as well.
Well, and it's not a long, long jump from that attitude of we're going to do whatever it takes, forget what the laws say, to business ethically questionable things, to the culture inside the company of misogyny and very bro-y and doing what it takes and all those things that combined really to this is not too strong a word, to shatter Uber's reputation, right? I mean, you think about Susan Fowler, that engineer who came public with her story in 2017, and it all kind of goes to heck.
That's totally right. I mean, I just read a piece in the Washington Post this week that said even 2 years after Uber has a new CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, even all these ads that they've plastered all over the place, and their reputation is still in the tank. Because I think the founder really just sort of implanted his DNA on the entire internal culture. And I think it's very difficult to change a company's DNA once it gets to a certain level.
Can we just say for a second here that as ubiquitous as this company has become, it is still losing hundreds of millions of dollars. It hasn't actually made a dime in profit.
That's right. I mean, this is the sort of grand irony of Uber. It really did change the world in ways that we couldn't have anticipated. There's all sorts of different ways it's having effects on how the cities operate, how we get around, how food and retail works. And at the same time, maybe the business model might not actually work. The CEO has said specifically, we don't expect to be profitable in the near term, and just hold on with us because, you know, we anticipate becoming the Amazon of transportation one day.
Yeah. And, you know, we all know that Amazon didn't do really well until it started doing really, really well. Right. So that's the parallel there. A word here about it, how it changed the world, which undeniably it did. But in a very specific way, it changed the labor force. Right. I mean, Uber was, if not the first, but at the very front of the gig economy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's this whole entire other battle on what labor rights are going to look like in a post Uber world. I think It really was one of the first companies to pioneer this hybrid model of contractor, or at least popularize contractor gig part-time labor force. It's really difficult to reconcile that. And right now there's a fight going on that all of the companies, not just Uber, but all of the gig economy companies are pushing in California to make sure that permanent contractor class is permanent. So it's ongoing.
Do me a favor and step back, would you, and apply, just to circle back to where we started, and this idea that Uber is a jerk, right? Silicon Valley is full of, would-be wunderkinds, most of them dudes, most of them very full of themselves, who, I guess it was Zuckerberg who said, move fast and break stuff. Is this kind of the way it goes in Silicon Valley, and is that going to change?
You know, it's funny. I think for a very long time, probably the last, 15, 20 years, there were examples like Zuckerberg or Larry Page and Sergey of giving all that power over to founders and having it really work out and everyone, at least in the Valley, getting rich.
Yeah.
And I think Travis Kalanick and Uber kind of represents the polar opposite end of that and what can happen to a company when you sort of give up all that power and let someone run rampant with their vision, and perhaps it can toxify an entire organization. So that said, a lot of people made out with billions of dollars. Yeah. Travis is a billionaire many times over, as well as all the VCs. So cynically, I don't know if anyone has really learned their lesson right now, and I'm curious what this next generation of companies are going to look like.
Mike Isaac covers technology for the New York Times out of Silicon Valley. His book, it's a really, really good read, I got to tell you. It's called Super Pump, The Battle for Uber. Mike, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Kai.
We, of course, have an excerpt for you. The bit Mike was talking about, Uber expanding into Portland by hook or by crook. It's at our website, marketplace.org. Here's a story about how the economic times, they are a change in the top 10 companies in this economy. The mainstays, the old reliables, have been pretty constant, right? The likes of GE and IBM, ExxonMobil as well. Until this weekend, that is. As of this weekend, for the first time since 1925, ExxonMobil is not in the top 10 anymore, as tallied by the good people at Standard & Poor's. Yet another indicator that old-school oil and gas companies just aren't the corporate titans they once might have been. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
We're number 12. ExxonMobil won't be chanting that, but it has been leapfrogged by Visa and Procter & Gamble on the S&P Top 10 list. Now, it's still a huge company, but a decade ago, ExxonMobil went on a run of six straight years at number one. Today's rankings are topped by Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon. Here's independent investment strategist Ed Yardeni.
Energy is simply not the sector that it had been in our economy. It's relatively small. Meanwhile, other sectors have been growing very rapidly, like technology, of course. Financials are large, as is healthcare.
Four decades ago, energy companies made up 25% of the S&P 500 index. Now it's 4%. These days, oil prices are soft and energy stocks are underperforming, especially ExxonMobil, says Amy Myers Jaffe at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Back in the day, ExxonMobil was considered a blue chip that was a must-have, but in recent years, it has not been well-performing.
She says some big investors consider all oil companies exposed to climate change risk and that fossil fuel use will taper. But Mark Stokel, the CEO at Adams Funds, says any energy transition will take decades.
The notion that electric vehicles or wind or solar is going to take away a lot of demand, the numbers really just don't play out that way, especially over the next 10 or 15 years.
Stokel expects energy laggards in the market to come back, given how important oil and gas are to everyday life. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
she's really turned herself from an ingenue into an institution.
A certain blonde-haired pop star. Straight ahead. Any guesses? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 285 at the closing bell today, 1%, 26,118. The NASDAQ off 88 points, 1.1%, 78.74. The S&P 500 lost 20.6%, 29.06. Retailers slipped with those new tariffs we were telling you about. Kohl's crept down 2.2%. Today, GameStop down 4%. Bond prices, well, they rose. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note sank to 1.46%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. With the understanding that you can't unring the trade war bell, we're going to spend three and a half minutes right now on a what if. What if there hadn't been a trade war? What if the uncertainty and the costs and the plain old irritation of the two biggest economies in the world going at it just hadn't happened? A little alternative history, if you will. Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. That's at George Mason University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So we should say before the president kicked in with his tariffs, and let's reference this as the steel and aluminum tariffs of a year and a half ago, just as a starting point. The general business and economic environment that he had engendered was reasonably pro-growth.
It was. He walked into, you know, a party that was getting ready to go pretty strong. Things are starting to look different now.
Well, let's talk about what happens had he not, back in the early days of 2018, said, let's put some tariffs on. What are the things that tick through your mind when I say, you know, what if?
So one thing I think we should all keep in mind, though, is that the U.S.-China trade tensions have been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. But if he wouldn't have done the tariff road, I think the Fed might not feel under – I'm not saying that they do feel under pressure, but –
Well, there's certainly the perception of pressure, right?
I mean,
you know, Chair Powell says all the time, I'm just doing my job, but, you know, pressure is pressure.
Right. They wouldn't feel this pressure to stave off the ill effects of these escalating tariffs, mm-hmm. because the escalating tariffs do have an effect on U.S. manufacturing, and the retaliatory tariffs do have an effect on ag. And all these things play into U.S. economic growth and unemployment and inflation and all the things that the Fed looks at. Right. And had it not been for these tariffs, you know, that part of the equation wouldn't be there. Right. Now, they would be under other pressure. Obviously, you know, global issues. Brexit was going on, you know, regardless of the tariffs. It looked like China was maybe slowing down anyway.
Right.
But this definitely seems to have sped things up and exacerbated the bad parts of all of that.
Let's take some sort of geopolitical context and roll it in here. The president has been mercurial in who he's going to tariff and how he's going to tariff them and when they get tariffed. Talk to me about, and maybe this is outside your area of expertise, but relations with our allies and the rest of the global economic community.
I think the tariff approach has eroded trust, right? It's not just tariffs on China. It's, you know, it's threats of tariffs on autos, using tariffs for other purposes. So you look at the EU. I mean, we want a lot of other things from the EU. We want ag market access, regulatory cooperation.
Right.
But are the EU leaders willing to expend that when, you know, after all that work, then they could just get threatened with auto tariffs the next day?
All right. So here's the $64,000 question. And I get that it's kind of unknowable, but if we had not been in the middle of this trade war, would people be talking about a recession as much as we are?
It's hard to tell. There are other global factors. I mean, right. I think of Germany, right? Germany is one of those countries when their big export markets sneeze, right? They get right. the flu. And when they get the flu, you know, Europe comes down with pneumonia. So what we've done is really taken a big shot at a big country in Europe when they were already dealing with Brexit and already dealing with a potential China slowdown. And we sort of like gut punched them, you know, right when they were starting to slow down anyway. So that's an example mm-hmm. of where you think, well, if, you know, it's just the tariffs, but, you know, it actually, it has this sort of cascading mm-hmm. effect. Mm-hmm. Europe is, once they slow down, it takes them a long time to get back up.
Christine McDaniel, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University up near Washington, D.C., doing a little What If with us. Christine, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
It's the teensiest bit of a mixed bag for Taylor Swift and her new album on this day after Labor Day. It debuted at number one on the Billboard 200 chart, but it did so on fewer total sales than her last couple albums, less than a million copies in its opening week. Still nothing to sneeze at, of course. Also, just the latest twist in Swift's career, which has seen her go from country music singer-songwriter to global pop icon in a very brief 10 years. Kate Nibbs wrote about the ups and downs of Taylor Swift's brand for The Ringer. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll tell you what, I am nobody's idea of a Taylor Swift scholar, but even before reading this piece and now having confirmed it reading this piece, the thing that's amazing about her, to me anyway, is how in 10 short years she has changed, and she has changed through all kinds of crazy difficult circumstances.
There have definitely been a lot of ups and downs in her career over the past decade, that's for sure. Mostly ups, though, I think. She's definitely been on more of an upswing than a downswing.
She totally has. And I guess the gist of the piece is the intentionality with which she has approached all of this, right?
Yes. Taylor has come under fire over the years for being a bit calculating, but I don't think that's a negative thing. She's very shrewd in almost everything that she does and the way that she approaches her career. And it's been reflected in great success. She's really turned herself from an ingenue into an institution in the past decade, which is admirable.
So I'll tell you, I didn't actually mean to throw this question out, but I will. Do you suppose she gets some of the opprobrium that she does get, right? Because she takes a lot of fire, as it were. Is that because she's a young woman, do you think? I mean, you're not hearing, you know, Justin Bieber get this kind of stuff.
I think it has to do with the fact that she really leans into the idea that she is a young woman and that she is very guileless. She has had some agency in the fact that the narrative around her has been that she is this sort of Disney princess character. And then when she does things that contradict that narrative, people tend to get upset. So I think that does play a role, but then there is always the element of sexism at play, too.
Yeah, for sure. Where does she sit in the pop constellation today? Because as you point out in this piece, she's been around a long time. She's changed her brand. She's changed her reputation. She's doing a different kind of music. And while she is the institution, somebody like Billie Eilish, right, the up-and-coming, I don't even know how old Billie is, like 17, who just kicked Lil Nas X off the number one spot, has the cool factor, right?
Yeah, I think Taylor's days of having the cool factor are over, if they ever existed at all. She's always been appealingly corny in my eyes. But I talked to a lot of music critics while I was researching the piece, and they time and time again said, you know, it's Taylor Swift, Beyonce, and Drake right now. Those are the people who have essentially become institutions, become too big to fail in the music industry. She doesn't have the critical love that Beyonce does. I don't think anyone does, but she is in a very rarefied echelon of pop stars right now. And yeah, I think she's got staying power.
Since you mentioned Beyonce, I think there's an interesting difference in the way Beyonce approaches like album releases, right? And it becomes this entire event. You think of Lemonade and that whole deal that went with that, right? And it was a movie, right? It wasn't even a video. It was a movie that she put out, as opposed to Taylor, who like drops albums, you know, it seems like every time you turn around.
Yeah, Taylor still really abides by the one album every 2 years, do a big full rollout music release cycle.
Yeah.
She's very traditional in that way, whereas Beyonce has been more experimental. She did the surprise drop of her self-titled album in 2013 and then the surprise drop of Lemonade. So she's definitely playing with the format a little more, and Taylor tends to play it safe.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, and it's something you said a minute ago, and it's a little bit of a steal from the financial crisis, if I could just do a little cross-branding thing here. The idea that she is now too big to fail, what does that mean?
It means that even if she releases a real dud of an album and it's a critical and commercial failure, she will still be one of the most popular musical acts in America. And lucky for her, Lover is getting great reviews. It's on track to sell more than Reputation, so She's not really in danger right now.
Kate Nibbs, writing about Taylor Swift at The Ringer. Kate, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today out of Bentonville, Arkansas. Walmart CEO Doug McMillon, in a letter to employees, said that once the company works through its inventory, it's going to stop selling two sizes of ammunition that can be used in military-style weapons. It's also going to do the same thing for handgun ammunition, and it's going to stop selling handguns in Alaska, the only place it currently does sell them, so it'll be out of that market entirely. Market share-wise, it'll take Walmart from 20% down to about 6 to 9% of ammunition sales in this economy. Walmart stores, of course, were the site of two shooting incidents in just the past couple of months. Okay, that's all we got. Dow Industrials off 285 today, 1%. The NASDAQ down 88 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 off 20 points, about 0.6%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Samantha Fields, Joanne Griffith, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Mucci is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.